My name is Paul Charles Mims, spelt M-I-M-S, class of 1949. I was born October the 4th, 1923, in San Francisco, California. Shortly after my birth, my parents moved across the bay to San Anselmo. There we stayed until the summer of 1928, when my father, having completed his printer's apprenticeship, was required to go on the road for a year in order to qualify as a journeyman. My parents decided to make this an opportunity for visiting relatives. My father was from Alabama and hadn't been home in 10 years. Turtle Lake, Wisconsin was my mother's hometown, but she had a sister on a ranch outside Sheridan, Wyoming, and two more in Chicago. So with no map, little money, less equipment, trusting blind luck to see us through, my parents packed our Model T Ford and headed east over the mountains into the deserts of Nevada and Utah. Our first major stop was to be the Wyoming ranch. I was 4 and a half years old and don't remember much about the journey. However, motoring across country in 1928 was no small feat. Filling stations were rare and roads hazardous. Flat tires, busted rims, broken axles, ruptured fuel lines, of which we had one in the Great Salt Lake Desert west of Salt Lake City, were all part of the ordeal. Highways were often little more than a wagon track. There were stretches in Utah where the proper road disappeared and planks laid across the sand took its place. At one point, the salt flats themselves served as a roadbed. But our Tin Lizzie was a tough old car, and she made it all the way to Chicago in under 2 months. There we sold her and spent the winter with relatives. My father worked as a printer on the Chicago Tribune. Just before the new year, he bought a second-hand Dodge, a touring car with isinglass window curtains and a heater. Quite an improvement over the Tin Lizzie. According to a letter of my mother's, we made the trip from Chicago to Dothan, Alabama in 4 days. Then in March, we left my grandmother's farm and headed west on the old Spanish Trail. With luck, we should have reached California by summer, but our luck ran out in Beaumont, Texas. There in May, quite unexpectedly, my mother died. She bled to death from a ruptured ectopic pregnancy. Of course, I didn't know that at the time. I was told she died in childbirth. I didn't question the validity of that until years later when I bought a copy of her death certificate. It didn't much matter really how she died. The results were the same. Devastation. My father put me in a Catholic semi-orphanage, St. Charles Academy in Lake Charles, Louisiana. 2 months later, he sent me to my Alabama grandmother. And finally, 4 months after my mother's death, he called me back to Beaumont to live with him and his new wife, a Cajun widow named Laura Foreman, with a 12-year-old daughter. So I grew up in Beaumont, county seat of Jefferson, an oil-rich rice and lumber town on the Neches River. For a couple of years, my stepsister, Cora Lee, and I went to Catholic schools, then switched to public while our parents bucked the Great Depression on a very short shoestring. Along with the family garden, we did a lot of fishing, hunting, and berry picking to supplement the larder. I joined the Boy Scouts and was just 2 merit badges shy of being an Eagle when I lost interest. In South Park High School, I was a debater and a cheerleader. Texas in those days only required 11 years of schooling, so I was 17 when I graduated. I had no plans for college. A boy in my position either got a job or joined the armed forces. On August the 11th, 1941, I enlisted in the U.S. Marine Corps. It was my father's idea. He wanted me out of the house. The Marines were not my first choice either. I sort of stumbled into them after being rejected by the Navy for admitting I had allergies, and the Army for being underage. At the time, you had to be 18 to join the Army, and my 18th birthday was a couple of months away. My father couldn't wait that long, so I quit a job as a copy boy on the Enterprise and Journal and signed up as a regular Marine for a 4-year cruise. I didn't mention allergies, and the Marines didn't ask about them. 17-year-old boys were their specialty. My buddy, Fred Connerly, who enlisted with me, was only 16. He lied about his age, and his parents swore to it. Due to the duration of the war, my enlistment was extended by 3 months. December the 7th, 1941, I was in Agua Caliente, Mexico, at the racetrack, making the first horse bet, of my life. $2 to show and a nag that won. I collected $8 and felt triumphant. All that Sunday there had been rumors running through the grandstand that the Japs had bombed Pearl Harbor, but no one took them seriously. Rumors like that had been afloat on the West Coast all year. At 4 o'clock that afternoon, when the track closed, newsboys were in the parking lot shouting, "Extra! Extra! Pearl Harbor bombed!" That's when we knew for certain that we were at war. I was dressed in mufti, so when I got back to San Diego, the military police didn't bother me. All service personnel in uniforms were being ordered to their bases. Since this was probably the last liberty I would have for a good, well, for God knows how long, I decided to make a night of it, come what may, and didn't get back to my own outfit until the wee hours of the morning. I caught some hell for being late, but it was worth it. That Sunday definitely saw the end of the good old days of the pre-war services. We expected the Japs to land along the West Coast any minute. Had they done so, I doubt that we could have repelled them. My situation was typical. I had a 30 caliber, 1903, Springfield rifle, but no ammunition. The weather that winter in Southern California was wet and cold, but I had no rain gear. From December 12th until after Christmas, my motor transportation company drove continuously. We lived in our truck cabs, catching what sleep we could on the run. We were Company A, 2nd Service Battalion, 2nd Marine Division, hauling supplies and troops to beach positions around San Diego. During that period, there was no leave. And afterward, all liberty, when there was any, was rotated port and starboard. Since I was usually broke, it didn't much matter to me whether we had liberty or not. I was an 18-year-old buck private, making $21 a month, assigned to drive a 6x6 combat truck. That January, we helped load the 7th Marines, codenamed White, Poppy, Jojo, aboard a converted luxury liner, the SS Lurline, bound for American Samoa. The boy I enlisted with, my old school friend, Fred Connerly, was aboard. Later, when the 7th was sent to Guadalcanal, Fred collapsed on the beach, suffering from elephantiasis, called mumu by the natives, a mosquito-borne disease for which there is no cure. Only a change of climate can help. Fred survived long enough to become a medical doctor, dying when he was 37 years old from a heart attack, a delayed victim of the war. Until the autumn of 1943, my job was routine, either doing KP or chauffeuring officers or hauling supplies. Then one day someone told me of seeing a notice on the bulletin board asking for volunteers to fly gliders. That sounded better to me than driving trucks, and you got flight pay too. The only requirements were that you had to have at least a year of service and the rank of private first class. I met those qualifications, so without a qualm I signed up. A week later, I was dispatched to North Island Naval Air Station for a physical examination, which I passed easily. After that, I was told to stand by for further orders. The orders finally arrived in January 1943. I didn't know it, but I had volunteered for a secret, highly dangerous project that to this day is not officially acknowledged, so far as I know, by the Navy. Had I known it, it wouldn't have mattered. What does a 19-year-old boy care about danger? Why, it, along with sex, is the very spice of life. I was bored stiff by my job in San Diego. Now up in Lewiston, Idaho, where I was sent for flight school, I was in a captain's paradise. Here was a sawmill town and its twin Clarkston at the confluence of the Snake and Clearwater rivers, the very spot where once Lewis and Clark made camp, now empty of young men, the war having claimed them, and filled with nubile girls. On a hill overlooking the town was the Lewis and Clark State College, all of whose students were female. That is, until our Marine detachment took up quarters across the street from the girls' dormitory. Merry hell was had upon that hill for the next 6 months. Marine student pilots ranged in rank from PFC to sergeant major and in age from 19 to 28. For 6 months, we lived pretty much like civilians. All our instructors were civilians, even the pilots. Our nights were spent in frolic. Our days were divided between ground school in Lewiston and flying out of Clarkston. A chauffeured limousine transported us between campus and airfield. We studied theory of flight and theory of engines, physics and meteorology, subjects of no practical use whatsoever when it came to flying troop-carrying gliders. For that, all you really needed was the skill to get the unwieldy crafts aloft and safely down again. However, our program was the same as that designed for naval pilots. We started out in primary, flying Piper Cubs, and moved on in secondary to low-wing Fairchild M62Bs. Later in Fort Worth, we graduated to Navy N3Ns, a biplane known as the Yellow Peril. From there, we finally made the shift to gliders, the first glider being an English Hotspur. Meanwhile, in June, we completed our stay in Lewiston, and the co-ed, some in tears, saw us off at the bus station. All privates among us had been promoted to sergeant. A number of the girls had become engaged. For the moment, we were on our way to catch a train in Grainesville, the nearest railroad depot. Eagle Mountain Naval Air Station outside Fort Worth, Texas, was our destination. It was there, in Texas, that our dream of riding a boxcar into battle against the Japs on their home island was aborted. For reasons never explained, the Navy scrapped the glider program and returned us to the ranks of ordinary enlisted personnel. Being a sergeant helped soften the blow, but life in the service was never the same. From Texas, we were transferred to Cherry Point, New Bern, North Carolina. I went overseas as a property sergeant in a fighter squadron, VMF 324, attached to the 3rd Marine Air Wing. Toward the end of the war, I was detached, this time to the Navy on Midway Island as commander of the field police. It was there, in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, on a tiny atoll, that the war, for me, finally ended. Except for 6 glorious months in my own private Idaho, World War II was for me a long, lonely, boring experience. Hostilities ceased in August 1945, as did my 4-year enlistment. But getting back to the States for discharge was a problem in logistics. Troop ships were in short supply. After getting as far as Iwa Air Base on Oahu, I was stalled for over a month. Finally, in late October, along with several thousand Marines and sailors, I boarded the Kasan Bay, a baby aircraft carrier, bound for San Francisco. Stormy seas all the way. When we docked, the sailors were given shore leave, while we Marines were trucked to Treasure Island Naval Station in the middle of the bay and kept in quarantine, ironically inside of Alcatraz, before being shipped south to San Diego. Scuttlebutt had it that Mrs. Roosevelt was responsible for our detention. Supposedly, after visiting Marines on Guadalcanal, she was so disturbed by their behavior that she feared releasing them on the civilian population back home without a period of readjustment. Perhaps it wasn't by accident that our barracks was next door to a German prisoner of war compound. The only thing dividing us from the Krauts was a wire fence. During the day, they seemed to have the run of the island. Their work parties appeared everywhere, including our mess hall. They were our cooks and messmen, and did a superb job of feeding the thousands that filed through the chow lines. Finally, we were shipped south for discharge. It was hard to believe that in just a matter of weeks now, I would be a civilian again. Already the war was becoming a memory. Then on November the 11th, 1945, at Miramar Naval Air Station, in the foothills behind San Diego, I was given an honorable discharge from the Marine Corps. Now all I had to do was find transportation home. Thousands of freshly discharged servicemen and women were trying to do the same thing in the middle of a rail and bus strike. Trailways was the only bus line still operating. I was lucky to get a ticket on an overbooked bus headed for New Orleans via Beaumont, Texas. Crammed three to a seat intended for two, plus aisle jump seats, all of us, male and female, freshly discharged from one of the services, all of us suffered that long, claustrophobic drive with only an occasional rest stop, delighted, despite our discomfort, to be free at last and going home all in one piece, the happy, if uncomfortable, survivors of a global conflict that destroyed so many of our peers. While I was still overseas, I had decided to go to the University of Wisconsin. Having lost my mother as a child, I had idealized her. She was from Wisconsin. Therefore, Wisconsin had to be a wonderful place, and its university superb. The question was, would the university accept me with my shaky academic background? I applied for admission almost as soon as I got home. Good thing I did, too. Shortly thereafter, due to overcrowding, a ban was imposed on out-of-state students. As a backup, I also applied at the University of Missouri. Admission officers were being very kind to veterans that year. Both schools accepted me for the spring semester. Money was no problem. I had the GI Bill, indeed enough of it for 5 years of tuition, plus textbooks, living expenses, lab fees, everything. I also had saved several thousand dollars while overseas. I'm a little hazy on the exact details of the GI Bill. Seems to me that each veteran was entitled to a year of tuition plus expenses for each year served in the military. There was a monthly stipend of $75 for single students and $90 for married veterans. Later, for married couples, it was increased to $110. One January morning in 1946, just before dawn, I stepped off the train in Madison. The whole town was frozen tight in the belly of Old Man Winter. I had never seen so much snow and ice in my life, walking down the street in my thin overcoat, looking for a temporary lodging. I nearly froze. The university had warned me in advance that housing was scarce, so I took a room in a dingy railroad hotel a couple of blocks from the depot. The place was depressing, but the rent was cheap, and there was a Greasy Spoon Cafe next door. After breakfast, I hiked up State Street to the Student Union. To an ex-Marine enlisted man, the Student Union looked like a posh officers' club. I fell in love with the place. The Rathskeller became my second home. Speaking of home, it was tough to find housing of any kind near campus. Even the dorms were booked solid, those that weren't still occupied by the Navy V-12 personnel. For help, I turned to student housing and finally located a room in a private home near Truex Field. That necessitated long bus rides to and from campus. Classes hadn't been in session long before I met an ex-Marine named Chuck Davis, looking for a roommate to share expenses, which, if I remember correctly, came to $20 each per month. He had a large room off State Street, a block from Bascom Hill, a perfect location. Unfortunately, halfway through the spring semester, Chuck had a reoccurrence of malaria and had to drop out of school. To give you an idea of the tightness of the housing market, it only took 2 days to replace him with a 19-year-old engineering student from Sheboygan named Ray. Even though Ray had never been in the service and was a very conventional Catholic boy from a protected background, we got along fine. We didn't socialize much. He had a nice corn-fed Wisconsin sweetheart, a co-ed majoring in physical therapy from his hometown. They may have thought me a bit rough for their tender tastes, but there was no tension between us. We liked each other. Before the semester was over, Ray and I moved into a two-room apartment on the corner of Gorham and State. Now we had a bit more privacy, but still no cooking privileges, and we had to share a common bathroom with at least 6 other tenants. Ray and I remained roommates until summer. After that, I had the place to myself. In December 1946, at Grove's Food Co-op, I met and married, just like that in 3 weeks, Ann Lichten from Philadelphia, a University of Wisconsin co-ed majoring in early childhood education. Finding a place to live as a married couple was a real challenge. We ended up out in the sticks at the home of an agronomy professor who had converted his basement into 2 wretched, overpriced, $50 a month, one-room apartments that shared a common refrigerator, washing machine, and bathroom. Each unit had a couch that could be converted into a double bed. A hot plate was used for cooking. The wall between the units was so thin, every sound was shared. There was no private entrance. To reach the basement, one had to pass through the family living room. When summer finally arrived, we moved from the professor's house into the house of a professor's aging widow. Mrs. Waller, fictitious name, lived at 511 North Carroll Street in a rambling manse that had seen better days. Normally, she told Anne, she only rented rooms to single young men. But in summer, when students were few, she lowered the rent to $5 a week and let the rooms to whomever could afford them. Again, we shared a common bathroom with other roomers. There were no kitchen privileges. 2 things of note happened to us that summer. Our room was burgled, we suspected the housekeeper's son, Angel, and Anne found our landlady lying helpless at the foot of the back stairs, having fallen several hours earlier and laying there with a broken hip, plaintively calling for help. Anne summoned an ambulance. Later she visited Mrs. Waller at the hospital, where that unfortunate lady died within days. Shortly thereafter, we were looking for new quarters. That autumn, Anne turned 21 and came into a small inheritance from her father. On the strength of that, she decided to rent a brand new second floor, three-room, unfurnished apartment at 2614 Fairfield Place for the princely sum, I believe, of $115 a month. Our landlord occupied the first floor apartment. During the day while we were at school, he or his wife prowled through our quarters, read our mail, and left nasty notes. By February, we had had enough of this nosy couple and broke our lease. After selling just about everything we owned except our books and clothes, we found a single room in a three-story, mouse-infested fire trap on Langdon Street, next door to the Villa Maria, a girls' dormitory on the lakefront. We shared the bathroom with half a dozen other denizens, a mixed lot of both students and transients. The shower, I recall, was a tin stall that popped like a shot every time you stepped into it. Let me tell you, it was a cold trek in the middle of a winter night from couch to toilet, and sometimes a long wait in a frigid hall if someone beat you to the throne. The good part was that we could cook in our own room using our hot plate and toaster. That saved us a considerable amount of money. However, crumbs attracted mice. One night, as I sat pondering some forgotten lore, suddenly a mouse jumped into bed with Anne. I wouldn't have believed a girl could climb a wall barehanded while screaming if I hadn't seen it with my own eyes. You would think a mouse in bed with your spouse might compromise a marriage. The odd thing is that despite our Dostoevskian lodgings, we were not unhappy. Like a promising dream, the future still lay beckoning before us. We were together. Our days were spent in class or with friends. Our evenings were spent in the historical stack studying until the library closed at midnight. Then after coffee and spud nuts on State Street, we walked to our drab shelter for a shared night on a narrow couch in close quarters. Anne, having concluded her bachelor's degree ahead of me, agreed to babysit the six-month-old boy of an Israeli couple working on PhDs in return for the use of their kitchen. Thus, we were able to have at least one home-cooked meal a day, namely lunch. However, since the Israelis were kosher, we had to supply our own dishes and silverware, plus cooking utensils. The child was named Amos. His parents had little time for him, so he was passive, apathetic, a pudding of a baby. With Anne and me, his passivity disappeared. We took him with us everywhere. Before long, he was calling us Mommy and Daddy. By the end of that spring semester, he was a lively little boy. Parting with Amos in May was painful. Our last abode before graduation was the front living room of a private domicile at 931 West Johnson Street, an address that probably doesn't exist anymore. That was the school year of 1948-49. We had spent the summer in New York City, where Anne taught in a nursery school while I recovered from knee surgery, the result of a war injury. In September, I returned to Madison a couple of weeks ahead of her to find a place for us to live. While I was searching, an acquaintance, Ralph Peterson, let me stay at his place rent-free. And his co-ed wife, he and his co-ed wife, had this two-room apartment on University Avenue, a block from Park Street. One room they rented out to students. Since the occupant wasn't there at the time, I used his bed. I mention this because Peterson, who had been 4F during the war, was a known leftist and minor local celebrity. During the war, a short story of his had been published in Story magazine. So in his own mind, he was right up there with William Saroyan. He also had a local radio program on which he reviewed books. Occasionally, he was even asked to do book reviews for the Chicago Tribune. If the Tribune had known just how far left of center Peterson really was, they wouldn't have touched him with a Russian ruble. That information came my way by inference and by chance. Peterson was an insomniac, as well as an egotist. When he couldn't sleep, he prowled the streets of Madison, in need of an ear to hear his sad tale of how, except for that one triumph in Story magazine, he had been ignored by publishers. And to hear of his adventures as a union organizer in the Deep South, I was pressed into service. Seeing as how I was living off his bounty, so to speak, I could hardly refuse. So we walked the night together, he and I. I got his life story, right down to how, while doing civil rights organizing in the South, he had joined the Communist Party. In those days, being a card-carrying Red was no joke. I thought he was kidding until Ann and I were up in his room while he was out, looking through a stack of bonus books he got as a reviewer, and found tucked away in the dresser drawer his party card. That is to say, Ann found the card, her curiosity being such that she could not resist prying. Not long after that, Peterson asked me to write some news releases for state candidates on the Progressive Party ticket. I did the pieces because I felt I owed him for the free lodging, but I felt uneasy about them, wondering if one day I might not be accused of being a pinko or a fellow traveler. I need not have worried. Meanwhile, our relationship crashed when Peterson made a pass at my wife after accusing me of doing the same to his wife. Peterson's prestige on campus was pretty well shot by this time. Years later, I heard he renounced the Communist Party, or perhaps they excommunicated him. Anyway, the last I heard, he was dead, possibly murdered, somewhere up around Baraboo. By that time, Ann and I had our own place. It had taken a week of door-to-door canvassing before I stumbled onto the Johnson Street accommodations. I was so grateful to have finally found a place that I didn't mind there being no cooking privileges. As usual, breakfast was eaten at Rennebaum's drugstore, lunch at the Ratskeller, later we used the Israelis' kitchen, and dinner, depending on our pocketbook, was enjoyed either in the cafeteria or Tripp Commons or the Ratskeller. Sometimes we treated ourselves to a Sunday dinner at the Georgian Grill. Occasionally we ventured out on the town and supped at the Italian Village on University Avenue or the Roman Inn out in what was then called the Bush, an Italian neighborhood near the university, or perchance the Flame or the Chocolate Shop on State Street. Before enrolling in the university, I had considered journalism as a career. My father being a printer, I had grown up around newspapers and even worked for a short time before the war as a copy boy. But once on campus, I had second thoughts about what I should study. It struck me that a good reporter needed a wide range of knowledge. A newspaper man had once advised me to major in English or political science. Anything, he said, except journalism. You can learn all you need about a newspaper on the job, he said. So I chose English, and later at the University of Pennsylvania took a master's degree in the field. After leaving Wisconsin, I worked as a police reporter for the Chicago News Bureau. That job convinced me I was no journalist. Teaching beckoned, and that finally became my career. Remembering those undergraduate years, two teachers stand out in my mind. Philo M. Buck, Jr., professor of comparative literature, and Helen C. White, professor of English. Of the two, Buck was the more popular. Through him, I was introduced to classical Greek literature, in translation, the Bible as literature, literary criticism, and Greek mythology. He made the study of literature a grand adventure. Professor Helen White, a novelist in her own right, taught me creative writing. I can still picture her, all dressed in lavender and lace, pedaling her bike around Madison, almost but not quite a caricature. Aside from literature, philosophy was my favorite subject. Generally speaking, the veterans were more mature and serious about school than their teenage cutouts. Many were married, some had children, and all were in a hurry to make up for lost time. Anne, though 2.5 years younger than I, was 1.5 years ahead of me in school. As for financing our education, she had a small legacy from her deceased father. I had the GI Bill of Rights, plus money saved during the war. Even so, my first semester, before I met Anne, I took a job as a sort of stable boy in Dr. Harlow's monkey laboratory. Dr. Harlow was the mad psychologist who operated on monkeys and apes, sticking probes and electrodes into their brains, trying, I guess, to understand what makes a monkey a monkey. I was hired to clean cages and feed and water the animals. All went well until one day a monkey made a monkey out of me by holding out his closed hand and grinning, obviously inviting me to accept some gift he held concealed in his fist. Normally this chap ducked out of sight when he saw me coming. Today, he stood his ground and grinned mischievously. I should have remembered to beware of primates bearing gifts. Touched that so simple a creature wanted to befriend me, I held out my hand to receive his offering. Whereupon he slapped a fistful of monkey feces into my palm and darted out of reach. I was nonplussed, embarrassed, outraged. In my confusion, I forgot to close the entrance to the monkey house, and 4 apes escaped into a sycamore tree. Even as I reported the breakout to Dr. Harlow, snow was beginning to fall and the temperature to drop. Professor Harlow must have envisioned his primate menage frozen in trees for all his critics to see, for as he dashed to their rescue, he yelled at me, "That's all I need. Another incompetent. You're fired." My feelings were hurt, but I stuck around long enough to watch him chat the apes out of the tree and back into their cages in a language known only to himself and his hairy proteges. Well, I didn't much like the job anyway, but earlier in the semester there had been a moment of recognition. A photographer from the Milwaukee Journal had taken my picture with one of the escapees sitting on my left shoulder. The photographer appeared in the photograph appeared in the Sunday edition of the paper and was noticed by relatives of my mother, who hadn't seen me since I was 5 years old and had no idea I was at the university. As a result, they invited me to a family dinner. Of course, among my acquaintances at school, there were some rude remarks made concerning the guy on the ape's shoulder. After the monkey caper, I tried one more job. A State Street restaurant offered tips and all the food you could eat in return for serving Sunday dinner. The food was excellent, terrific desserts, And the tips were okay, but the work smacked too much of mess hall duty. One Sunday meal was enough for me. Since I didn't need the money, I decided to dedicate myself to study and loafing. By nature, I'm not a joiner, although I rented equipment from Hoofers, attended plays, even appeared in one production of the Dramatic Society, and sometimes went to veterans' organizational meetings. I never joined any of these groups. Boxing was the only university sport I followed, probably because I knew a couple of the fighters. As for football, I do recall that in my senior year, there was loud student protest demanding the ouster of Coach Harry Struhlder. They held him responsible for the team's losing ways. Intramural sports were mostly confined to fraternities. During the years dominated by World War II veterans, fraternities faded almost into obscurity. We found them too juvenile. Before I met Ann, weekends usually found me at the Rats Dance Skeller or downtown at the American Legion Dance Hall. Joe Miller was the only fraternity man I knew. As his guest, I went to a couple of frat parties. If you overlook the beer and heavy sex, they reminded one of high school hops. When spring finally arrived in 1946, a pal of mine named Terry, who owned a beat-up pre-war Chevy, a law student friend of his, and I toured the outlying roadhouses and beer joints. Sometimes we drifted as far as Baraboo, looking for local action. Our trips were all in vain. All we ever picked up were headaches and lighter wallets. Still, there was a secret promise to those damp, chilly nights. Snow was melting, maple buds were waxing fat, streams were threatening to burst their banks, and we just knew that out there somewhere buxom beauties were awaiting the likes of us to pick them up. Trouble was, we couldn't find them. 1947 saw the birth and death of the Literary Preview, the literary magazine of the University of Wisconsin. I may have the only four extant copies. It was an impressive publication, printed on slick paper with an illustrated cover. Naturally, I appear in all four of the issues I possess. The March edition carried a foreword by August Derleth, the Sun Prairie novelist and anthropologist, warning neophyte writers of beginner's errors. Whereas I composed what I thought were poems for the magazine, for the Cardinal I wrote book reviews, there was certainly plenty to do on campus. One never had to go into town. In fact, that first winter, I seldom left the student union, except to go to classes or home to bed. Just about everything I needed was there. Food, drink, companionship, dance hall, library, music rooms, cinema and theater, barbershop, bowling alley, pool hall, notions and candy counter, even a hotel for visitors. Although born and raised a Roman Catholic, religion was never a large part of my life. As a child, I had it imposed upon me. As an adolescent, I tolerated it, and as an adult, I avoided it. Although there is much beauty and mystery in religion, overall, it seems to me more of a curse than a blessing. Politics is another subject that enthralls me not. However, my first friend on campus was a Jewish socialist, Henny Goldstein from Brooklyn, a rabbi's son, and a devout anti-communist. I was a New Deal Texas Democrat, a yellow dog Democrat, who barely knew the existence of, let alone the difference between, socialist and communist, not to mention Trotskyites, of whom there were several on campus. Henny found my parochialism amusing. He called me Tex and tried to wise me up to the political and economic realities, as he saw them, of America. According to the rabbi's son, if capitalism was vile, communism was evil, and Trotskyism contemptible. The difference between the latter two was too subtle for me to grasp. The only Trotskyite I knew was an aging part-time student and full-time janitor at the university who called himself Jack LeWitt. We had coffee together in the Rathskeller. Once he sold me a subscription to the Militant, the Trotskyite propaganda sheet he sold around campus. Jack loved reminiscing about the bad old days when in the 1930s, when the Trotskyites bloodied the heads of A.Y. Deers, American Youth for Democracy, a communist front organization which still had an active chapter on campus. Naturally, LeWitt and Peterson loathed one another. During the 1948 presidential campaign, the Progressive Party candidate Henry Wallace visited Madison and caused some stir. But for the most part, President Truman was the campus favorite. Truman actually rode down University Avenue in an open car, waving to those of us along the way. I had never before seen a president of the United States in the flesh. There was nothing in the way of protests, however, comparable to those of the Vietnam War days. There was a strong anti-communist feeling on campus, and protests were made against public figures like Paul Robeson when they appeared on campus. Overall, I don't recall any burning political issues, although the beginnings of McCarthyism were clearly present. Student protests tended to be of a more social nature. For example, there was a tremendous outcry by veterans against W Day, that day when football players were free to chase down coeds and kiss them. Many of these coeds were the wives of veterans. Most women had long resented this unwanted attention, but it wasn't until the vets joined the protest that it finally stopped. Letters poured into the university president's office. The cardinal also joined in the protest, and that brought an end to what some called a hallowed tradition. Then there was the case of the one-legged vet who lost his footing on icy Bascom Hill and slid, cane, artificial leg and all, down the slippery slope. Students demanded that salt be spread on the dicey walk. I also vaguely remember hearing that there was a rule about women not being allowed in the Rathskeller or the Paul Bunyan Room, but no one paid any attention to it. Some women felt discriminated against because they had to be in their quarters by 10:30 p.m. at weeknights, and 12:30 p.m. on weekend nights. There was also the matter of freshman girls having to undergo physical examinations given by male pre-medical students. Apparently the girls' measurements were compared and those most admired were deluged with requests for dates. As for racial bias, I probably would have been the last person to notice it. Coming from the South, the University of Wisconsin struck me as the epitome of liberalism. Until I arrived on campus, I had only heard of interracial dating. I had never actually seen it. The sight of a black man getting his hair cut by a white barber shocked me. I had the same barber cut my hair and asked him how he felt about cutting Negro hair. He didn't like it, he said, but he had to do it if he wanted to keep his job. For a month or so, I was discombobulated by all this public commingling of white and dark folks. In the South, we commingled too, but in a more covert manner. In time, the novelty passed, and by chance, a black graduate student from Wyoming, Kurt Gwynn, became a dear friend of mine. Indeed, one evening in the Rathskeller, Kurt defended me when a dubious character named Jack, a black alleged drug dealer from New Orleans via Chicago, took umbrage at my being a Texan. Looking back on that time, I don't remember any serious racial tension, nor for that matter do I recall any organized anti-Semitism. To be sure, there were bigoted individuals among us. By disposition and inclination, I gravitated toward the bohemian set who tended to be tolerant, judging individuals more by their lifestyle than their ethnicity. Drugs had not yet entered the mainstream of university life. They were used moderately by what was thought of as the arty set. They mostly indulged in marijuana, amphetamines, tobacco, and alcohol. I knew of only one person, an art major, who could be considered an alcoholic. Of drug addicts, I don't remember a one. Not once in my time at the university did I ever have contact with a dean. Dean Rudicelli's name does come to mind. I believe my wife taught one of his children in the university nursery school. From time to time, I would hear someone called into Rudicelli's office to answer for poor grades. If the grades didn't improve, the student would be put on probation. Overall, the deans, along with the president of the university, were rather like characters out of a Kafka novel, say the castle. I knew they were there. I just never saw them. The only characters that come to mind are the individuals we called campus ghosts. These were persons who continued to hang around the Rathskeller long after they had graduated. Or they were the perennial students who went on forever collecting course credits, if not degrees. Heath Jones was such a character. She was a blind lesbian poetess, left over from the 1920s expatriate crowd that once occupied Paris. Her significant other was a young woman graduate student in the anthropology department. Due to an operation for cancer, this graduate student was missing her left hand. I knew and admired both women. In fact, the graduate student, working on her PhD, had been my quiz instructor in Anthropology 1. After graduating from the University of Wisconsin in 1949, my wife and I drifted for a while. First, we spent some time on our relative's coffee finca in Mayagüez, Puerto Rico. From there, we moved on to Albuquerque, New Mexico, where I attended graduate school at the University of New Mexico. Then it was on to Chicago and a job as a police reporter for the City News Bureau, and taught school wherever we happened to be. It was in the Windy City, Chicago, that I, too, became a teacher. Gathering news no longer appealed to me. What I had once labored over, the next day was used to wrap fish in. Often when on the night beat, I wouldn't see Ann for days at a time. When she went to work in the morning, I would be sleepy. By 4 o'clock in the afternoon, when she got home, I would already be on my way to work. Sometime in the wee hours of the night, when the city desk couldn't locate me on a breaking story, usually a murder or a race riot, the night editor would phone Ann, wake her up, and demand to know where her husband was. Still half asleep and frightened, wondering what had happened to me, she would ask, "Don't you know?" Well, this sort of thing didn't make for a happy couple. Surely I thought there must be a better way to earn a living. Ann suggested I try substitute teaching in the public schools and see how I liked it. But first, I had to go back to college for the required professional courses needed for a certification. I still had some of the GI Bill left. Roosevelt College, now called Roosevelt University, I believe, and DePaul University provided these credits. When I was a student at the University of Wisconsin, teaching as a career never entered my mind. In those days, I thought I would be a writer, preferably a famous one. Of course, that never came about, but my days as an undergraduate, cliche though the thought may be, were among the most meaningful of my life. Both Ann and I so valued our university experience that we sent our only child, Drusilla Ann Mims, to our alma mater. Drew arrived on campus in 1970. That summer, someone blew up a university laboratory, killing a graduate student. Street people flooded the campus area. Walking down State Street in those days was like a short hike through limbo. Beggars and freaks, bikers and tattooed bimbos abounded, as did a ragbag army of drugged-out ladies and lost lads. These, I had to remind myself, were the children of yesterday's heroes. Ann and I were appalled. We feared for our daughter's welfare, but she, courageous as only the naive can be, matriculated her girlish way through the tricky minefield that passed for college in those days, and she, like her parents before her, got a first-rate education, both on and off campus. Quite likely her children, a boy and a girl, may one day find themselves within the same halls of ivy that once held their forebears. But maybe not. Drew married an Irishman, a citizen of Ireland, who himself now is a college professor teaching Irish studies at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, and their two children may end up going to Trinity College in Dublin. I don't know, maybe they'll go to both. Anyway, that is my story, and I am Paul Charles Mims, class of 1949, signing off, and hope this will help you in your future programs. Thank you.